Welcome to Healthy Outcomes, brought to you by Baker Tilly, bringing you the latest trends and hottest topics in healthcare. Baker Tilly is a leading advisory, tax, and assurance firm dedicated to helping healthcare organizations explore ways in which they can win now and anticipate tomorrow. Let's go there.
Hi, my name is Mark Ross, and I am the leader of Baker Tilly's healthcare provider practice. Joining me for today's Healthy Outcomes podcast is Celia Van Letten. Celia is a principal with the law firm of Miles and Stockbridge and is based in Baltimore, Maryland. Celia, welcome to the podcast. It's certainly a pleasure for me to have you as a guest, and I want to thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine, Mark.
Great. Well, today, Celia and I are going to be discussing several topics related to the healthcare regulatory environment. And every healthcare provider across this country knows that if you're going to play in the healthcare space, there's a lot of regulations that you need to navigate through and certainly comply with. And healthcare regulations, it's where Celia specializes in one of her specialties. So we're going to be basically touching on what we'd like to call, or Celia would refer to as maybe some legal hot topics in the regulatory space, if you will. But before we dive in, Celia, to the Q&A, the specific Q&A, can you give our audience a little more background on yourself and on Miles and Stockbridge?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So as you said, I'm a principal in the healthcare practice group at Miles and Stockbridge, which is a full-service law firm headquartered in Baltimore, Maryland. My practice focuses exclusively on the regulatory and transactional matters involving healthcare providers, digital health companies, and other stakeholders in the healthcare industry. I provide advice to my clients about matters involving fraud and abuse, healthcare licensing, HIPAA, and Medicare and Medicaid compliance. And I work on transactions involving healthcare providers, payers, investors, and digital health companies. Before we begin, I would like to give a very brief disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast and delivered as part of this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. The views, opinions, and positions that I express are mine alone and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, or positions of Miles and Stockbridge.
Okay. Well, thank you for that intro, Celia. A little more background on yourself and Miles and Stockbridge. And of course, the disclaimer. We can all understand disclaimers,
yes,
right?
Exactly. So, I wouldn't be living up to my title if I didn't give a disclaimer before I said anything.
Good deal. Well, I will tell you, you mentioned the word transactions several times as you were giving our audience some information on your background. And so let's start with mergers and acquisitions and those transactions. And as we know, and our audience certainly knows, there's been a great deal of M&A activity in the healthcare provider industry for some time, for years. Mm-hmm. And years ago, Celia, the transactions seemed to be smaller. I mean, some of the healthcare provider related transactions, especially when we think about healthcare systems today, the transactions do appear to be getting larger, right, as the years have gone by. Really big systems coming together with other really big systems. So from a regulatory perspective, how are the regulators reacting to all of this consolidation that, again, it's not a current event. It's like it's new. It's been happening for some time, but it does seem like the transactions are getting larger. So how are the regulators feeling about this, Celia?
Yeah, so I mean, you're absolutely right about the influx in M&A, both big and small within our industry, particularly over the last 15 years or so. There are a number of drivers around this trend, and one of the bigger ones these days seems to be the economies of scale that you get through consolidation. It is just so enormously expensive to provide high quality healthcare, and providers are leaning in more than ever to take advantage of that scale through different types of combinations, affiliations, partnerships, whatever you want to call it. We've also, of course, seen a big uptick in private equity investments in the healthcare industry. I actually recently read that private equity investors are estimated to have been involved in 35 to 40% of healthcare acquisitions that occurred in 2023, which is just a really huge number. So with the flurry of transactions generally, plus the rise of PE investors, federal and state governments have been reacting so far with a lot of skepticism. So you have on the federal side, the Biden administration has made very clear that they're concerned about the involvement of private equity in the healthcare industry. The federal government already has a long-standing pre-closing review process for those really big transactions that you talked about, which is done by the FTC and DOJ under the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. So there is at the federal level a built-in framework for allowing the federal government to review those really big transactions, including those that involve private equity. We've also seen workshops and inquiries by a number of federal agencies that are looking into this issue, kind of studying so far, as well as some proposed legislation that would potentially subject private equity investors to additional requirements associated with investing in healthcare companies. And then you have on the state side a few different factors at play. You have the longstanding role of state healthcare licensing agencies that have the authority to review and bless any change of ownership or control that might affect a healthcare provider's license. We've always had to deal with these licensing hurdles in connection with transactions, but we're really seeing these state regulators now ask a lot more questions than they used to about how the transaction will particularly affect operations post-closing. On the state side, we've also had a growing number of states that now require state-specific notice for healthcare transactions that have a lower threshold for review than what's required under a federal law. So you have states like California, New York, Illinois, Massachusetts, Oregon, Washington. There are some of the dozen or so that have these requirements. And while antitrust review might be part of what the states are looking at there, some of them are looking into issues that are really unique to the healthcare industry, like cost, access to care, and quality. It's not just a pure antitrust review like you have on the federal level. So the effect of all of this scrutiny really means that healthcare providers are having to account for longer pre-closing review periods to allow the various regulatory reviews to be completed. And they're having to share more information about their transactions and the players involved than they may have had to in the past.
Wow. So certainly a lot going on there from federal, state scrutiny on these transactions. And Celia, I don't even know if there's an answer to this question. So if you can't answer it, you could just tell me. I can't answer it, Mark. But from a transaction perspective, whether it's two large, say, not-for-profit healthcare systems coming together, or whether it's a private equity firm investing in a healthcare-specific provider, I mean, how many of these transactions don't get approved percentage-wise by federal and or state regulators? I mean, there's certainly some, right, where the federal government says maybe it's antitrust or some other issue that they have with it. But there is a percentage that are not getting approved these days, I would imagine.
Oh, certainly. There are some that don't get approved, or that, you know, where the parties involved see the writing on the wall and decide to divorce before they even get married. So I think both of those factors can come into play there. But you know, there is absolutely a percentage that don't withstand the scrutiny. And some of them will contest it and fight for it. And then others will walk away and try to find other opportunities.
Sure. And those denials, if you will, or the fact that these transactions may not get approved, you know, they're for a variety of reasons. But going into these transactions, I would imagine when you're working with your healthcare provider clients, I mean, those clients are going into these things eyes wide open, knowing that, hey, there is risk of approval here, maybe because of these reasons. And I guess, you know, you're doing everything you can do, and the provider's doing everything they can do to mitigate those risks, right, of not getting approved.
Oh, absolutely. So what we do in those situations is we really bring in special antitrust counsel to really help to identify and frame those issues very early on and be able to take into account the various regulatory reviews that have to happen, concerns, considerations, thresholds for review. And they can really help with things like deal structure and structuring a deal to position it in as positive a way as possible to try to get the deal approved so that you don't have that denial on the back end.
Sure, sure. Great. Well, I appreciate that. And again, you mentioned antitrust, one of the big, maybe big hurdles that these transactions need to get through. But access to care, you know, quality of care, obviously near and dear to every regulator's heart these days, for sure. So a lot to think about relative to the regulatory requirements, scrutiny, et cetera, around these transactions. So, Cecilia, let's pivot to staffing for a moment here. And staffing has been an issue in the healthcare industry for years, right? I mean, staffing costs, personnel costs can be, depending on the specific service lines or how a provider is structured, it could be 50% plus, 50 to 60% of their operating expenses, right? Or personnel related costs. And there are some current challenges. I know in the skilled nursing facility area, there's some new minimum staffing standards that CMS has recently put out. But overall, from a staffing perspective and you connecting staffing to regulations or the regulatory environment, can you spend a few minutes on that for me?
Sure, happy to. So as you said, healthcare providers have been dealing with staffing shortages for many years, but it was really the COVID-19 pandemic that kind of, you know, turned up the heat on that and really made it into the crisis that it is today. And unfortunately, I don't think the government has been terribly helpful in turning things around. So we're seeing this play out in a big way with that new CMS nurse staffing rule for Medicare and Medicaid participating nursing homes that will increase nursing home staffing obligations at a time when they're already experiencing significant staffing issues. So the CMS rule as of today requires nursing homes to provide 24-hour licensed nursing services that are, quote, sufficient to meet resident needs. So it gives a lot of discretion to the nursing homes to figure out what their staffing plan should be. The new rule is incredibly prescriptive and has a specific hour requirement down to, you know, the 100th decimal for how many hours per resident day of direct nursing care residents should be getting, how much of that needs to be provided by registered nurses, how much can be provided by nurse aides. It's incredibly specific. Additionally, under current CMS rules, there's a requirement to have a registered nurse on site 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. And under the new rule, a registered nurse will need to be on site 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it's not terribly surprising that the new staffing rule was very quickly challenged in federal court. There have also been some legislative efforts on the Hill opposing it. So at the moment, really what we're doing is watching to see if there will be any reprieve or delay on this one before it starts to, where the bigger requirements start to phase into effect in 2026. Mm-hmm. A handful of states already have their own minimum staffing rules, some for hospitals, some for nursing homes and other types of facility-based healthcare providers. But so far, they don't really seem to have helped to improve the staffing issue in any meaningful way. So really what I've been seeing my clients and others do is to take the staffing issue into their own hands by supporting their existing workforce and making their organization a supportive, safe place to work so they can retain their talent and organically attract new talent. And of course, they're filling in the inevitable gaps with locums physicians, foreign educated physicians and nurses, traveling nurses and staffing support. And of course, what's the talk about healthcare without talking about AI these days? There's been a lot of talk about how AI can be used in different ways to take some of the burden off of staff and free them up to do other things.
Sure. Yeah. So staffing continues to be an issue, not only hiring, right? Recruiting and retaining nurse staffing, but now we've got the regulatory requirements that we need to. So what are the, again, maybe another unfair question, Celia, but I know you mentioned some of the pushback that the regulators have received relative to the SNF, the skilled nursing facility minimum staffing standards. Do you think they're here to stay, though, these minimum staffing standards? Are they going to stick?
That's the million-dollar question, right? I think some of that will play out. So there are a couple of different reasons why we're kind of all watching this happen. There was a recent decision by the Supreme Court that's really changing the amount of deference that federal courts are required to give to federal agencies when they interpret their statutes through regulation. So courts are now free to make their own determinations about reasonableness rather than deferring to the administrative agency's interpretation of the statute. So we could see some movement away from the staffing rules because of the recent Supreme Court decision overturning Chevron. Additionally, we have an election coming up. So the administration's priorities could potentially change depending on who the president will be as determined later this year. So I think we have, you know, a lot of factors in play that really make this a dynamic issue. And I think we're all wondering how it's going to turn out. I mean, the government, I talked a little bit more about the sticks that the government is using to try to improve staffing through having these minimum staffing standard rules. To be fair, they are throwing some carrots out there too. They're trying to have more funding and more programs that are encouraging and incentivizing people to receive education in the various health professions. So they are doing things to try to encourage, you know, movement and education through the healthcare industry. But I'm sure any executive at a healthcare provider will tell you today that these minimum staffing standards are in no way helping the situation.
Sure. And yeah, and so what we're telling our clients is that the regulations are there, right? Mm-hmm. And they need to plan as though they're not going away, right?
You can't. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't plan hoping that they go away. You need to operate your business to comply with all of these new standards and all the other regulations that are out there. So pivoting it again to another topic, and you mentioned artificial intelligence or AI already. You made reference to it, Celia. And certainly AI is being talked about more. You know, it's not new to the healthcare space or the healthcare sector. And it's becoming, I think, a little more pervasive, not only really, and I'll talk about it twofold or mention and then turn the floor over to you. Certainly on the administrative side of the house, you know, there's AI related technology that's being deployed to make maybe some of the administrative functions more efficient. But then you've got the whole patient care side of the world where AI is being deployed there. And so my question for you is, from a legal perspective, is there a legal framework that healthcare providers should be aware of or be considering as they evaluate their own use of AI-enabled technology?
So we really have two types of legal frameworks to consider as it relates to AI. The first type is the existing bodies of laws that aren't specific to AI, but are implicated when a healthcare provider uses AI-enabled technology. The second type is somewhat of an emerging patchwork of laws that are specifically regulating AI. And I'll talk about this first type first. So in terms of existing laws, the ones we talk about quite a bit when dealing with AI are the federal and state health data privacy and security laws like HIPAA. Any vendor that will have access to protected health information in connection with standing up AI-based technology will be a business associate of a HIPAA-regulated healthcare provider, and will need to sign a business associate agreement along with any services agreement for the technology itself. What's a bit unique about the AI vendors, though, is that they're often asking to use the provider's protected health information to help train and improve their AI product. It's really the data that helps to make the AI smarter and better. And vendors are also asking providers to use their protected health information to develop other AI-enabled products. So we have to think about these different use cases in the HIPAA framework, which is very restrictive in terms of the data rights that HIPAA-regulated entities can grant to their vendors. Some HIPAA-regulated entities are also engaging in their own development and commercialization of AI-based technology. You're seeing that quite a bit in academic medical centers, university-based hospitals. So they really view their protected health information and even their de-identified patient information as a real asset. And from what I've seen recently, they're more hesitant than ever to give a lot of those rights to a vendor if that means that the vendor can use their data for the vendor's own commercial purposes. So because of that, we're seeing HIPAA-regulated entities heavily negotiate their services agreements and business associate agreements with new AI vendors as it relates to things like data use, de-identification, post-termination uses of data. We're also seeing a lot of attention paid to intellectual property rights that are granted in those agreements. And of course, allocating risk in the event of a breach because we are dealing with identifiable patient information. Turning then to the second type of legal framework that I talked about, the newer laws that really are specific to AI. We have a patchwork emerging where certain applications of AI are specifically regulated. At the federal level, the FDA provides clearance for AI-enabled medical devices and software, and you have the Office for National Coordinator of Health IT, which recently got an even longer name, but they regulate the certification of AI-enabled health IT products. CMS has also gotten into the mix. They issued guidance about certain applications of AI by Medicare Advantage plans and making coverage decisions. But at this point, it's like I said, a bit of a patchwork. At this point, we do not have a comprehensive national AI law like the one that was passed earlier this year in the European Union. The Biden administration and Congress have made some baby steps towards regulating AI, but any kind of comprehensive regulation could slow down the innovations that are happening in this space. So I don't think we can expect Congress to move as quickly as the EU did there. And in the absence of federal regulations, of course, the states have popped up with their own flavor of regulation. I can't say there is any universal theme that has emerged from their efforts so far. They're kind of all over the map. Some of those laws are really focused on bias and discrimination issues. Others are focused on how AI is used in making employment decisions. Others are looking at how AI is used to profile or segment categories of people in different settings. It's really all over the map, and I'm sure we'll continue to see a lot more state activity on this issue in the next year. So with all of this excitement over AI and the legal considerations that I talked about, what healthcare providers should be thinking about now is putting a governance framework in place that will help to define the organization's ethos around their need for AI and to set some parameters around where and how it will be used. It's a bit of flying the plane at the same time as it's being built, because most providers are already using AI in some capacity, but we're still early enough on in this to be able to put some governance framework around it.
Sure. And although the providers, as you mentioned, a number might be using AI today in some capacity, I think the use of it is only going to continue to expand and increase. So that governance framework will become increasingly important. So staying with the technology theme then, Celia, let's flip over to breaches, you know, cyber breaches in the healthcare industry. It seems to be something that's happening more and more frequently. And some of these breaches are very, very well publicized. Some very large healthcare systems have been exposed. You know, the Change Healthcare situation that happened in early March of 2024, which has impacted healthcare providers all over the country. It was, again, another well-publicized breach. And we talk about actually these breaches a lot on our different podcasts, because it's just something that comes up when we're talking about healthcare specific topics. But from your perspective, you know, why do you believe there's been, and I'm sure you're talking to a lot of your clients about breaches that they may have been exposed to, but why do you think there's been such an influx of these breaches or an elevation in them? And what should healthcare providers be doing as you're talking to your clients about, you know, what recommendations are you making relative to how they can be prepared to handle one?
Sure. So, I mean, you're certainly right about how common they've become in the healthcare industry in particular. Healthcare providers have really troves of data about their patients, which makes them a high value target for cyber criminals. They have all of the demographic information needed to steal someone's identity, like, you know, name, address, date of birth, social security number, really have the keys to the castle there. But they also have health insurance information that can be used by criminals in health insurance fraud, which is quite valuable in the black market, because that health insurance fraud can really go undetected for a long time. And then, of course, for a provider, you have this data for thousands, if not millions, of patients. So you also have the inherent value of the medical records themselves. If they're not accessible to providers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it's more than an inconvenience. It's a real patient safety issue. So we've seen cyber criminals exploit this vulnerability through ransomware attacks, where they can demand large ransoms in exchange for the promise to make the records accessible again, which they may or may not do in the end after they get paid. It was actually ransomware that caused the Change Healthcare breach that you mentioned that happened earlier this year. That took a huge number of healthcare providers offline with respect to their claims processing functions. It was absolutely crippling for so many providers, and many of them are still dealing with the effects of it. The HHS Office for Civil Rights, or OCR, they're the federal agency that enforces HIPAA. They have taken 3 enforcement actions against HIPAA-regulated entities who are affected by ransomware. It may seem counterintuitive for the government to go after the companies who really were victims of these crimes, but once the government becomes aware of a ransomware attack, either through a breach report or the media, they have enough to know that there was at least a potential violation of HIPAA and have the authority to investigate the company's HIPAA compliance program writ large. From OCR's perspective, their rationale is that if you have a strong compliant HIPAA program, then ransomware shouldn't happen. I don't know if that's necessarily true or not, but that's their position. And sure enough, in the 3 enforcement actions they've taken so far involving ransomware, at least, they did find, among other issues, that the HIPAA-regulated entities did not have up-to-date HIPAA security risk analyses, and they didn't have effective HIPAA training for their workforce. So today, providers really need to assume that privacy and security incidents, including breaches, will happen, and they should ready themselves to be able to quickly identify, respond, and mitigate those incidents when they happen. Putting your head in the sand and saying, oh, we never have any of those issues and our, you know, our policies sit on the shelf collecting dust. Really, that's more worrisome to me at this point because we know that they do happen. The world of providing and paying for healthcare is really complex. So much of it is electronic. These things are inevitable, really. So your best bet is to have a living, breathing HIPAA compliance program that works for your organization, that is tailored to your organization, that is up to date, and that your workforce is trained on. There's no one right way of doing this. This really can be tailored to work for your organization. The real cornerstone of the HIPAA security program is the security risk analysis and risk management plan. And not having one has been the downfall of most healthcare companies that have been subject to enforcement actions by OCR. It's one of the first things that OCR will ask for when they're investigating a breach or a complaint. So it is just really important to make sure that it's done on a regular basis and that it accounts for all of the information systems that maintain or transmit your patient information.
Sure. No, very well said, Celia. So the HIPAA compliance program, the security risk analyses. It's interesting, these ransomware attacks or these cyber breaches are really impacting providers of all different shapes and sizes, right? I mean, it's not just the big healthcare systems. You know, we do a lot of work, as you know, in the continuing care retirement community space. And over the last 12 months, we've had a handful of clients that have been breached. And so it's interesting. I don't think the cyber criminals are discriminating based on size necessarily, although the bigger the target, probably the better for the criminals. But nonetheless, it is difficult for the smaller organizations that maybe don't have scale, they don't have a lot of resources to button everything up. I mean, no system is ever bulletproof, but it's harder for the smaller provider, Celia, I guess is my point, to make sure they're dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's and trying to be as secure, make their systems as secure as they possibly can be.
You're absolutely right. I mean, OCR, to their credit, has tried to put out more resources that are specifically targeted to helping smaller healthcare providers comply with HIPAA. They have a toolkit that can be used. It's free. Anyone can go on the OCR website and find it. And this toolkit really takes a small provider through the security risk assessment process. So you don't have to hire a big fancy third-party vendor to do this for you and then pay a different vendor a whole bunch of money down the road to implement it. You know, that's always an option. However, it's not a requirement. And OCR does acknowledge that resource differences across different types of providers are going to come into play in terms of how the organization is implementing HIPAA compliance. So, you know, I would commend any smaller provider in particular to look at the resources on OCR's website to see if it, you know, can give them enough of a roadmap to do some of this on their own. It's better to do something than, again, like I said, to bury your head in the sand. And there are many ways to get to HIPAA compliance. There's no one size fits all path. So I certainly would commend anyone who's looking for additional resources to check those out on the OCR website.
No, great advice. Great advice, Celia. So we talked, and actually we've been going for about 30 minutes here, Celia. So I just have a final comment that I'm going to make, and maybe you can comment on my comment. But, you know, we could talk about regulations and, you know, other regulations for the next day, right? The next day straight. There are so many things that healthcare providers need to worry about. So we just touched on a few today. We touched on M&A activity, some staffing, regulatory issues, AI, and you just addressed breaches, cyber breaches. So we just hit on four, right? And there's hundreds of things we could talk about. So the regulatory scrutiny, I guess my comment is the regulatory scrutiny that healthcare providers are subject to on an ongoing basis is very, very intense. And, you know, based on what you talked about here today, Celia, I certainly don't see the scrutiny lessening as we move forward. And there is certainly a need for laws and regulations, right, in the healthcare space, no doubt. But it is a real burden to comply, for organizations to have these compliance programs, and again, to dot the I's and cross the T's relative to everything they need to be worried about and comply with on an ongoing basis. So from your perspective, and I guess this is my softball question for you, is that I guess you don't see this the regulatory scrutiny, the regulatory environment lessening in intensity. I mean, it's going to continue to be there, and providers just need to figure out a way. As you said, there's no one size fits all to most regulations, but they need to figure out a way to make sure they're compliant.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I have a mentor who used to tell me, I mean, this was probably 15, 16 years ago at this point, but he used to tell me that, you know, what is commonplace in one industry can be criminal in healthcare. So you have to be really careful. So it's always been a heavily regulated industry. It is only getting more regulated, and it's a really complicated environment, especially for, you know, going back to talking about the new PE investors. I mean, those who are not familiar with how heavily regulated the industry is are oftentimes stunned about, you know, the hoops they have to jump through to do something that was commonplace in a different industry. So I think, you know, with all of that, it's compliance in particular is not, certainly not a revenue generator for any healthcare provider. It is part and parcel with doing business in this industry and, you know, having competent counsel to help guide you and really be a partner with you to help achieve your business goals, to serve your patients, your community, your staff, your personnel is critical to getting you there these days.
No, well said. Well said. And I think that's a great way to close things out here, Celia. So again, I want to thank you for joining me. A real privilege to have you as a guest today. And I also want to thank our listeners for joining this podcast. If you found this episode useful and would like to listen to more episodes about hot topics in the healthcare industry, please subscribe to our Healthy Outcomes podcast or learn more by visiting us at bakertilly.com. Celia, thank you again.
My pleasure.